Good morning, everybody. I hope you've been enjoying your practice and that things have been going well for you at the retreat. As you know, this is going to be the last Dharma talk I'll give during this retreat, so I want to combine some elements that we've been studying with some other really primary teachings from the traditional and historical literature of Zen to help clarify what the teachings that I've offered so far have been pointing to, or maybe I can say they've been kind of leaning in the direction of from the beginning. Friday's teaching brought in that wonderful excerpt from the Mahanibbana Sutta, the Buddha's last days, where the Buddha encouraged those who follow the Buddha way to study in themselves what are called the five skandhas that are considered the basic elements or building blocks, or we might say the five ever-changing streams that flow together and make up human beings. A skandha can be translated fairly literally as a heap or an aggregate or an aggregation. And in the case of human beings, these five aggregates or streams are form, feeling, perception, impulse or inclination, and discernment, which can also be translated or understood as consciousness or awareness. So form, feeling, perception, inclination, and discernment or consciousness, like we chant in the Heart Sutra. And as we heard, the Buddha said that these should be contemplated in themselves, so deep, not contemplated with ideas about them, but actually experienced and contemplated in themselves. So that we do it so deeply that we come to know how they came about and what they're made of, which is called their impermanent, ever-changing non-self elements. So even though they feel really solid and like they've been there or will be there forever, it's not really true about them or anything else. And that we contemplate them so that they no longer have the ability to entrance or pull us away from what he called the signless concentration of mind, that spaciousness, a vastness of mind, where we can touch and know what we might think of as the larger or the deeper or the true self, where the Dharma will be found. And just to be clear, the word Dharma, because not everyone knows it, refers to the Buddhist teachings, of course, but very importantly, it also means truth or reality. So the truth or reality of things. So the Buddha is saying that because what we truly are is already just right here in our ordinary selves, when we practice in this way and move beyond the various kind of spellbinding attractions or annoyances sometimes of the apparent impermanent self of the skandhas, then we can realize what we are if, to quote him, if we are willing to learn. The Buddha also taught that abiding in the signless concentration of mind of this self helps us to reduce or even to move beyond dukkha, beyond discomfort and suffering. And for those of us in the Mahayana Bodhisattva path, this is no small thing, since this path is intended to bring an end to suffering for all beings. Then on Saturday, we studied a bit with Zen Master Dogen. Wouldn't that be nice? Excuse me. To do, but we did. We studied a bit with Zen Master Dogen, whose teachings and practices from the 13th century pretty much determine how we practice right here today and how Zen is practiced all over the world. Zen Master Dogen Zenji, is our great Japanese Soto Zen ancestor, who recorded and taught everything that he had learned in China when he studied with Ru Jing, his Chinese teacher, and as well what he learned in his own practice in Japan when he before he left and also when he returned. And he recorded and taught all of this just in case, as he wrote in Endeavor of the Way, Bendoa, there may be a few stray students who want to touch the real self and know the true self as it really is. So that's why he, out of his great generous spirit, he wrote everything down. And Dogen, whose realization led him to say that enlightenment is just intimacy, or, as you've heard me say, non-separation from or oneness with all things, encouraged us to maintain continuous ongoing practice so that we might experience the wholeness that we are, moment after moment after moment of our lives without being pulled away, without distraction. And then through cultivating the deep reality of what we are, through continuing practice, we can fully express the Buddha way on behalf of all of life. So in these two teachings, both the Buddha and Dogen each offered a way for people to awaken the heart and mind, or heart-mind. As you've heard me say before, the Chinese character pronounced Xin means both heart and mind is just one thing. So they offered a way for us to awaken the heart-mind to what it really is, as a means of benefiting both the practitioner and also the world by reducing and bringing an end to suffering. So what I'd like to do now, as I said, is to bring in a few more teachings from the vast literature of Zen, which is really quite vast. It's amazing how extensive it is. Because it just may be possible, just the slight possibility that there is some slight residue in our thinking that the mind that the Buddha spoke about and the heart-mind of wholeness or oneness with all things that Dogen always encourages us to study intimately is some special kind of mind, or the kind of mind that is, excuse me, beyond what ordinary people like us can realize. I was inspired to think deeply about this by encountering a woman that I met in late April when Kaz Tanahashi and I and some others went on a pilgrimage and were practicing at the Tiantong Temple in China, where Dogen studied with Ru Jing, the actual temple, and where Dogen came to his full realization. And when we arrived, our wonderful Chinese guide, Eric, brought us to where we would be sleeping at the monastery and said that the woman he introduced us to would take care of everything for us during our stay. So we met this wonderful woman, who's about my age, seemed to be about 70 or so, and I asked Eric, how should we address her? And he said, just please call her Jusha. So Jusha got all 10 of us sorted out into our rooms and handed each of us a cloth for washing and drying ourselves. And she did this without any fuss, I noticed it. Very calm and very steady way. And I have to say that when I got to my sleeping quarters and I felt the hardness of the mattress, which was just slightly harder than a solid plank of cedar, and then looked at my washing drying cloth, just one cloth for washing and drying, which was a really beautiful, bright, bubblegum pink, and at best, it was about 10 inches long and about 7 inches wide, and I thought, okay, so this is the Tiantong Hilton. I'm not going to go any further into all the incredible practice opportunities and the wonderful encounters that we had while practicing at Tiantong Temple, at the monastery. But one afternoon, as I came back to my room, I saw Jusha sitting outside in the courtyard on a chair in the sun. And her head was bowed down a little bit. I thought maybe she was resting. She was surrounded by all the sheets and the little towels and the personal items that she had washed and hung out to dry. So I thought, you know, reasonably she might be taking a little rest in the sun. But as I came up closer behind her, I saw that she had a book in her hands. And as I kind of, you know, stealthily stepped even closer, because I was curious to where I could sort of peek over her shoulder and see what that book was. I saw, and then I heard that very quietly, she was completely absorbed in chanting a sutra, and it was one of the sutra books that I recognized. And continuous practice. This idea of continuous practice was learned by Dogen at this very temple. And there are many ways to do it, but Jusha was showing me what it could look like. Surrounded by all the sheets and the towels and the undergarments and the robes and everything else that she had washed and hung out to dry. There was no damask silk or brocade, I can tell you that. But what there was Jusha. Devotedly following and manifesting the teaching in this way of continuous practice. When I returned home to Canada, I kept thinking about Jushir and this little scene. Of all the things that we did, my encounter with the Tenzo, who was drying mushrooms in the part of the temple, just as Dogen had described the Tenzo doing, which I wrote to the Sangha about, stayed with me. But also this little scene with Jushir stayed with me. And I wrote to ask Eric if please send me the characters for the word Jushir. I wanted to know about them. So Eric did send them to me, and I looked them up in my Chinese dictionary, and I found that Jushir means householder. And for some reason, this word, when I read that, this word meant a lot to me, given what I had seen in Jushir. It really rang inside me like the enormous Buddha bell that they rang at the temple. So I wrote to Eric again, and I asked him if there were any references to these characters. By the way, Jushir is pronounced Koshi in Japanese. I asked him if there were any references to these characters in Buddhist or Chinese Zen literature, and he replied right away, yes. He said that Vimalakirti, who was a not ordained practitioner at the time of the Buddha, who none of the Buddha's ordained disciples wanted to debate, because Vimalakirti's understanding was so complete that he would demolish their arguments like that. Vimalakirti was known as householder of Vimalakirti. So these characters were actually part of Vimalakirti's name. And there is the famous Vimalakirti Sutra. And householder of Vimalakirti is in the title of the sutra about him. And also Eric said that the same was true for the famous ancestor who's usually called Layman Pong. It makes sense, right? Householder Pong, who also was so quick to express his penetrating understanding and realization that that the anecdotes and the stories about him and his daughter, who frankly surpassed her father, Zen expression, she was way ahead of him. But these anecdotes and stories remain part of Zen teaching today. And finally, Eric said that the great 8th century Tang Dynasty poet, Wang Wei, whose wise and beautiful poetry is among China's greatest poetic expressions of Zen, that Wang Wei also had as part of his name, I think it's a Wei Mo, the word householder, and was sometimes known as householder Wang Wei. So I thought all of this was really important, because it shows the honor in being householders that these Zen and Buddha ancestors possessed. And the stories and the poems that they left behind make clear that full realization is not reserved for any special group of people, that it's ecumenical. Full realization is just us folks realizing what we are as we practice this wonderful expression of what we are, and the practices that you've been doing and that we do on a daily basis in our daily lives, in our ordinary way, with our ordinary minds. I don't think this is any small thing. I think knowing this can just really wipe out any ideas of special categories. Which brings me to the teachings of the Zen ancestors and the key stories about them that I promised that I would bring in today. So I'd like to start with my lung is getting healthy, but I'm sorry you have to hear me cough. I'd like to start with what is arguably one of the three or four most well-known stories about Zen's first ancestor in China, the person who brought Buddhism from India to China, Bodhidharma, who left India and arrived in China in 527 CE, Common Era. And this is a key story in Zen. After Bodhidharma arrived from India to China, he landed in Guang province, and the governor there sent a message letting the emperor know, Emperor Wu, about the arrival of this very strange-looking but special Buddhist person from a foreign land. And when Emperor Wu heard this, he was very excited. He sent a messenger to invite Bodhidharma to the palace. So Bodhidharma went to went to the capital city, and he met with Wu, who said to Bodhidharma, "You know, ever since I became emperor, I have built temples and copied sutras, and I've approved the ordination of more monks than I can even count. So please let me know, what is the merit of my having done all this?" And Bodhidharma looked at the emperor and said, "There is no merit." And the emperor was quite surprised, and he said, "Why is that so?" And Bodhidharma told him, "What you've done, these are minor achievements of humans and devas, which become causes for desire. They're just like shadows of forms, and they're not real." The emperor was quite surprised, and I imagine disheartened, and he said, "What is real merit?" It's a good question. And Bodhidharma said, "When pure wisdom is complete, when pure wisdom is complete, the essence is empty and serene. Such merit cannot be attained through worldly actions." The emperor took this in, and then he asked a very good question, because Bodhidharma was helping him to get down to it. The emperor said, "Well, what is the foremost sacred truth?" And Bodhidharma replied, and this is his most famous statement, probably. So the emperor asked, "What is the foremost sacred truth? What is it? What is that? Bodhidharma said, "Vast emptiness, nothing sacred." In that moment, the emperor looked at Bodhidharma and said, "Who is it that faces me?" And Bodhidharma said, "I don't know." The emperor didn't understand what he was being told, and Bodhidharma knew that there was no merging between the two of them and that the time was not yet ripe. So without any further discussion, he left the emperor's presence and the palace, and he traveled north to Luoyang. And he stayed at the Shaolin Temple on Mount Song, where he sat facing the wall in silence, day after day after day. And it is his wall-gazing practice that you've been doing during this retreat. Every time we turn from the first sitting where we face each other and turn and face the wall, this is based on Bodhidharma's wall-gazing practice. It's said, as many of you know, that he sat facing the wall of his cave for 9 years. So we don't have so much time, but let me just say that when Bodhidharma said to the emperor, who had been looking for merit, looking, as I think most people would, for some kind of advantage or some kind of gain for his activities in the name of Buddhism, when Bodhidharma said that the foremost sacred truth is vast emptiness, nothing sacred, he was offering the emperor a great gift. He was offering him a window into his real nature that cannot be gained. And that doesn't have to be gained, because it is already the emperor's nature, and it is the nature of all things. Vast emptiness. Beyond any ideas that we create about sacred or mundane, or something being merit-worthy or special, or something being ordinary, or something high or something low, just vast emptiness. Just nothing sacred. This is the treasure the treasure that the emperor had been seeking, but he did not know that he already had. But Bodhidharma saw this, and what he saw was further confirmed when the emperor asked, "Who is it that faces me?" And Bodhidharma replied, "I don't know." This phrase, "I don't know," was another gift. It was a true and, I feel like saying it was a realized response that means who I am and what I am and what all things are, in fact, is beyond knowing or not knowing. It's beyond saying or not saying. It's beyond fame or name or gain. It's like when a Zen teacher's staff strikes the floor, just that. But as I said, Bodhidharma saw that the time was not yet ripe for the emperor. So he left the presence of the emperor and traveled north to where he began and introduced to Zen the practice of facing the wall. And what's important about wall gazing, people call it navel gazing, which is kind of cute, but what's important about it is that in facing the wall, we limit the external distractions. So the distractions are really limited to our minds themselves, which in time will come to know how to sit beyond the mind's distractions, just as the Buddha and just as Dogen taught. So it's actually very helpful to face the wall. Sometimes we call it facing the world. And of course, we are. Before leaving Bodhidharma, I just want to mention that also that, this response of Bodhidharma's, "I don't know," is also a perfect expression of vast emptiness. And that the don't know mind, in other words, the mind that's not caught or clinging to any idea, even of itself, the don't-know mind practiced in our wholehearted sitting of Shikantaza, as Dogen taught, as well as of the signless concentration of mind the Buddha talked about. It's the same thing. This signless concentration of mind and the don't-know mind, so-called don't-know mind, is an expression of vast emptiness. Many people can say it's an experience of, but I prefer to say it's an expression of it. We may not actually experience it. No, because there may be no one there to experience anything. Anyway, this mind I'm speaking of does not depend on and is not conditioned by anything that might be called sacred or special, but it is cultivated by continuous practice. And as my teacher used to say, echoing Dogen's teachings, if it is practiced, it is realized. A little later on in the 8th century, another of Zen's great ancestor named Nanxuan lived in southern China, which is where Tiantong Monastery was and where we had to traveled. I was amazed to see how much of Zen comes from the southern area of China. Nanxuan was a descendant of Mazu, about whom there are many, many Zen teaching stories. Really, he was quite an incredible master. And in the collection of koans called the Mumen Gan, which means the gateless gate, this koan appears. So this koan is, people think of it as a riddle. It's really just a public case that then gets discussed. And it involves Jiaozhou, who Jiaozhou became, or sometimes called Joshu. Jiaozhou became a great Zen ancestor as well. So Jiaozhou asked his teacher, Nanxuan, "What is the way?" And Nanxuan replied, "Ordinary mind is the way." So Jiaozhou asked, "Shall I try to seek after it?" And Nanxuan responded, "If you try for it, you will become separated from it." "But how can I know the way unless I try for it? Zhao Zhou asked, really persisting. A very good student. And Nanxuan said, the way is not a matter of knowing or not knowing. Knowing is delusion. Not knowing just brings confusion. When you have really reached the true way beyond doubt, you will find that it is as vast and boundless as space. How can it be talked about on the level of right and wrong? Or I might add, this is not Nanxuan speaking, but how can it be talked about in any dualistic categories? And with those words, Zhao Zhou came to a sudden realization. And in time, Zhao Zhou became Nanxuan's Dharma heir. So here it is once again. Ordinary mind, vast and boundless as space. And yet, to make some sense of it, if you think about it, for the universe, space is just what makes it up. And beautiful as we find it when we look up at the Milky Way, say, or you know, during the time of the shooting stars, space is just what the universe is. So it's marvelous to us, and from the point of view of the universe itself, it's just space. So it's pretty ordinary. And it's the same for what is being called ordinary mind. It's vast, it's empty, it's marvelous. And because ordinary mind is just itself, without anything added, we can say, well, it's just ordinary. It's like Baijong, sitting on Mount Baijong, as the most extraordinary, ordinary thing, which I mentioned to you in a talk the other day. I think it's quite important for us to really study intimately, to quote Dogen, ordinary mind, what this really might mean. Another lesser-known story about Nanxuan, but one that I really love and that really shows ordinary mind in action in a way. If only the monk in this story had the ears to hear what he was being told, is this one. Zen Master Nanxuan was once on the mountain working, as he did every day. And a monk came by and asked him, what is the way that leads to Nanxuan? So this is the kind of question that is either asked for teaching, when a student or disciple is asking a teacher for their teaching, or it's meant to test someone's dharma. And Zen literature is filled with these kinds of conversations, as I'm sure you know. So the monk said, what is the way that leads to Nanxuan? And Nanxuan raised his sickle that he was working with and said, I bought this sickle for 30 cents. So the monk said, I'm not asking about the sickle that you bought for 30 cents. What is the way that leads to Nanxuan? And Nanxuan said, you know, it feels really good when I use it. So, I think this is a great teaching on ordinary mind. I think this monk was a little like Emperor Wu with his gaining idea. I remember I told you this, but the morning that I took my vows and precepts, I had a Dokusan with my teacher, and I said to him, gee, it's kind of a great day, huh? He said, yeah, good day. And I said, I thought maybe he forgot, you know, I said, yeah, you know, we're gonna do the vows and precepts today. This is about 5:30 in the morning. He said, I said, so can we, maybe you can give me some kind of, I would be very grateful if you can give me some kind of teaching on the precepts and vows this morning. And he said, oh, yeah, okay, precepts, vows, okay, let's see. Okay, don't lie, don't let's see, don't lie. Okay, don't, okay, okay, don't kill, don't lie, don't lie, don't steal. He said, yeah, I'm not sure I remember them. So, yeah, many stories like this in all of our lives. Anyway, finally, to bring this theme forward in the Zen tradition, and because I actually do feel the pressure of time due to our schedule, I feel like I almost feel like I'm parked outside at a meter. Anyway, we come again, as we must, briefly to Eihei Dogen in the 13th century in Japan, who taught us that we should, and I'm quoting him now, sit Zazen wholeheartedly and let go of all things. Then, leaping beyond the boundaries of delusion and enlightenment, free from the paths of ordinary and sacred, immediately wander at ease, enriched with great enlightenment. When you practice in this way, how can those who are concerned with the traps and snares of words and letters be compared to you? So it's pretty clear that Dogen saw all mental constructions, such as ideas of sacred and profane or mundane, or as traps and snares of words and letters. And yet, and this is very interesting to me, Dogen also taught quite explicitly that all dharmas, each and everything, is what he called sacred. Now, isn't that interesting in light of what Bodhidharma said? Right? Vast emptiness, nothing sacred. And Dogen taught that each and everything, each dharma, is sacred. So what can Dogen mean? We might think, is this just Dogen creating another one of his linguistic koan-like paradoxes to force our minds to go beyond thinking? It's possible. But my sense is that in this case, Dogen is not creating oppositional categories like sacred versus mundane. But in line with his entire lifetime of teaching, he's encouraging us to recognize the undeniable wholeness and all-inclusive nature of each thing. Remember, he is the person who taught that when we become intimate with any single dharma, when we realize the true nature of any single thing, all things will be found right there within that dharma, within that thing. So for Dogen, this is the key to experience the preciousness and the wholeness of timeless life, no matter what we encounter and no matter what we do. As my teacher used to tell us, everything you encounter is the self. So I think, at least as I understand this, the fact that Dogen did talk about the sacredness of each thing, I think that's what he was doing. And Kaz Tanahashi and I tried to reflect this idea in the brief introductory remark that we wrote at the head of the chapter in our book, Essential Dogen. The chapter was called Each Activity is Sacred. Excuse me. And here's what we wrote. Mindfulness and a respectful heart in each moment are applied equally in meditation and other daily activities, including work, interaction with others, and cleansing one's body. Practicing and living in this way helps us to clearly see, understand, and value what is right before us as none other than the wholeness of life itself. As Dogen says, even our eating bowls are the body and the mind of Buddha ancestors. So you can see right here, this is continuous practice, right there, in what Dogen is saying. Mindfulness and a respectful heart in each moment are applied equally in meditation and other daily activities, including work, interaction with others, and cleansing one's body. Practicing and living in this way helps us to clearly see, understand, and value what is right before us as none other than the wholeness of life itself. Even our eating bowls are the body and mind of Buddha ancestors. That's old Dogen. And so to make this teaching clear, Dogen also wrote, when you prepare food, take up a blade of grass and construct a treasure king's land. Enter into a particle of dust and turn the great Dharma wheel. Do not arouse a disdainful mind when you prepare a broth made only of wild grasses. Do not arouse a joyful mind when you prepare a fine cream soup. Where there is no discrimination in the mind, how can there be distaste? Thus, do not be careless when you work with poor materials or increase your efforts when you have excellent materials. Never change your attitude according to the materials. If you do, it is like varying your truth when speaking with different people. This is not how to practice the way. So as I see it, this is an essential teaching for the steady, calm, clear-eyed equanimity that can be found in I'm stopping because I'm thinking equanimity brought in equality. So let me say it again. This is an essential teaching for the steady, calm, clear-eyed equality and equanimity that can be found in taking care of what is right in front of us with a mind of no preference, a non-discriminating mind, a mind that does not make things into categories, labeling them as high and low, better or worse, which is what I saw in Jushi, who practiced and lived the ordinary mind of what might be considered a householder's precious or sacred life. So our ordinary minds, from the very depth of what they are, have made so many wonderful things that we use in our ordinary lives. And so, to honor this, I hope you won't mind, but I want to end with a poem that I probably have read to you before, because it just honors the ordinary fact of things and the capacity of our ordinary minds to be intimate with the world around us, both so-called natural world and also the world of things that we make, in a way that shows the experience of non-separation that Dogen spoke of, and it shows it from a poet's perspective. And so, as some of you may guess, the poem I want to end my Dharma talk with is Pablo Neruda's poem, or a translation of it, called Ode to Common Things. I have a crazy, crazy love of things. I like pliers and scissors. I love cups, rings, and bowls, not to speak, of course, of hats. I love all things, not just the grandest, also the infinitely small, thimbles, spurs, plates, and flower vases. Oh, yes, the planet is sublime. It's full of pipes weaving handheld through tobacco smoke and keys and salt shakers. Everything, I mean, that is made by the hand of man. Every little thing. Shapely shoes and fabric and each new bloodless birth of gold. Eyeglasses, carpenter's nails, brushes, clocks, compasses, coins, and the so soft softness of chairs. Humankind has built, oh, so many perfect things. Built them of wool and of wood, of glass and of rope. Remarkable tables, ships, and stairways. I love all things, not because they are passionate or sweet-smelling, but because I don't know. Pablo Neruda, Bodhidharma. I love all things, not because they are passionate or sweet-smelling, but because I don't know. Because this ocean is yours and mine. These buttons and wheels and little forgotten treasures. Fans upon whose feathers love has scattered its blossoms. Glasses, knives, and scissors all bear the trace of someone's fingers on their handle or surface. The trace of a distant hand lost in the depths of forgetfulness. I pause in houses, streets, and elevators, touching things, identifying objects that I secretly covet. This one because it rings, that one because it's as soft as the softness of a woman's hip, that one there for its deep sea color, and that one for its velvet feel. Oh, irrevocable river of things, no one can say that I loved only fish, or the plants of the jungle and the field, that I loved only those things that leap and climb, desire and survive. It's not true. Many things conspired to tell me the whole story. Not only did they touch me, or my hand touched them, they were so close that they were a part of my being. They were so alive with me that they lived half my life, and they will die half my death. And so, I hope you enjoyed that, and thank you once again for your sincere practice throughout the whole retreat. And I'm going to ask Judith now to help organize the final talking time for the retreat. Thank you once again.